This is Rebecca from New Haven, Connecticut. You are listening to WNHH Community Radio 103.5 FM.
Welcome to Book Talk, where we talk about books. I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and today we'll be talking about the novel Mother of Invention, first with the author, Shaley Wolfson-Widger, and then with my guests, Tui Sutherland and Brian Slattery. And stay tuned at the end of the show for a middle grade recommendation from one of our friendly New Haven librarians. How might the lives of women change if pregnancy were 9 weeks instead of 9 months? Tessa Callahan, a kind of Uber Sheryl Sandberg, aims to find out. Her company, Seahorse Solutions, is pioneering the inaugural trial of this new technology, based off of a seemingly spontaneous medical aberration 2 decades ago, where dozens of women experienced this kind of accelerated gestation for no apparent reason. What Tessa does not know is that there are dark secrets lurking in the origins of her technological innovation. Secrets held by her business partner Luke. Secrets held by the current Big Brother-like American regime. Set in a not very distant future, that looks, perhaps, all too much like the world we live in now. This is a novel about gender roles and the meaning of motherhood, the threat and promise of technology, and what we are and are not willing to sacrifice in the name of progress. I had the opportunity to speak with author Shaley Wolfson-Widger last week, and I'd like to share that interview with you now. Widger earned her MFA from the University of Montana. She now runs a recruiting firm for technology startups in Santa Monica, California, where she lives with her husband and 3 children. Mother of Invention is her 2nd novel. Shaley, thanks so much for joining me today on Book Talk on WNHH Community Radio 103.5 FM.
Thanks, Sid. It's great to be here.
So, Shaley, at the time of this interview, as you and I just talked about, I am 25 weeks pregnant, and I am still feeling terrible. And the idea of a 9-week pregnancy, I have to tell you, sounds pretty good. So I'm curious about where this notion of accelerated gestation started for you, whether it was your own experience with pregnancy or witnessing that of friends that made you think of it, or just something else entirely.
Like you, I was not quite 25 weeks pregnant. I believe I was in my 2nd trimester with my 3rd child. And I was working full time and had 2 other children who were quite small. And the morning sickness, which we all know is a wild misnomer.
Morning sickness.
Was not dissipating. And I was just feeling really overwhelmed and, you know, excited about the 3rd baby, but really tired of being pregnant. I just wanted to cut to the chase. I was also, at the time, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In had just come out. So this was about 5 years ago. And I was reading it at the time. I was working in a corporate technology setting that she writes about. And it brought up a lot of feelings for me. And so those kind of uncomfortable slash somewhat worked up feelings, along with being somewhat miserably pregnant and trying to do it all, came together, marinated. And the accelerated pregnancy sort of came to me when I was lying in bed. And then it just kind of grew from there.
So I'm curious that you mentioned Sheryl Sandberg. You know, your protagonist, Tessa Callahan, in some ways feels like a direct descendant of hers. The book obviously references the book Lean In that you mentioned.
Right.
For me, that book's very much tied up with the Anne Marie Slaughter article in The Atlantic about how women can't actually have it all, which I actually see as kind of a very different take from Sandberg's. And I'm just curious about how you encountered both of those. You've talked a little bit about how you were reading Sandberg's book, but, you know, what they made you think of and how you feel that the novel is a response or in conversation with them.
There's a particular detail in the Anne Marie Slaughter piece that was a direct triggering force for this book. And I'm going to take it out of context here because I haven't read the article in a while, but she talks about shaving off as much time as you can to kind of pack in as much into your day as possible as a working woman. And she talks about not taking the time to, you should always pre-program your microwave. Or she might be quoting someone who says this, but she talks about just shaving off seconds by never actually keying in, you know, 300 into your microwave. And that really resonated with me. I thought, that's what I'm doing. I'm trying, that's where my margins are. I'm trying to shave down microwave key tapping time. And so I remember that. And then with regard to the Sandberg book, which I think now 5 years later seems almost antiquated, in that the thesis that I, as I understood it, and this is implicit, she never, Sandberg never comes out and says this, but it's implicit that the system, and she's specifically talking about corporate structures that are inherently patriarchal in nature, suggests that those really aren't going to change, or that it's more effective as a woman if you figure out how to best play it within the confines of what we have now, figure out how to lean in and, you know, power through your pregnancy, sit at the front of the room, fire off emails in the bathroom at Little League.
Mm-hmm. I remember that detail.
Yeah, exactly. So kind of how to just jump into the system as it is and make it work for you, get ahead, you know, perpetuate your career, just go all in to the system as it exists. And that was daunting to me and also sort of lonely. And that feeling that I didn't agree, it also on a gut level, I didn't buy it either. And so that, you know, that was another big motivator or emotional trigger for the book. And I'm pleased to say that I think 5 years later that, you know, things are looking different. I think the spirit of Me Too is very much lean on to each other, if you will, instead of just leaning into the system and lean against the way things are. And so that's been heartening. But yeah, I had kind of a counter reaction to the central thesis of Lean In.
I'm interested to hear you say that you feel like things have changed in the past 5 years. I still feel like there is a way in which the system is still designed around a kind of very male model of working. And so there is still an expectation that if you want to get ahead, you'll work full time, for example.
Yeah. Right.
And more than full time. And maybe you can go home to get your kids dinner, as Sheryl Sandberg says in her book, but then after dinner, you're going to be doing
it. Open that laptop. Yeah.
Yes. So do you really feel like there's been a shift in those kinds of dynamics, even as much as kind of the conversation around like, let's women as women support each other?
You're right. No. In practice, I don't think it's changed yet. I work, you know, I run a staffing company. So I'm watching women move through the hiring process. And I work with a lot of female executives. And I would say things haven't changed. You're absolutely expected to work full time. Never mention your kids in an interview. I don't care how many nursing rooms there are, you know, in the workplace. Nobody wants to hear about breastfeeding. Yeah, definitely expected to work after hours. In fact, I think the notion of flexible schedules and working remotely, while it's good in some respect in that you can run and pick up your kids and be home with them for dinner, but you are expected to compensate, you know, in the off hours. So, no, you're right. I think in practice, it has not really changed. I guess I'm talking more about a spirit that's emerging, and I'm hoping that it will manifest in a pragmatic way. You know, this sort of change is, it's sea change, and it's slow to come. So I think we're just at the genesis, but I'm hopeful. But you're right, it's still very, very rough.
So I'm wondering if you would call Mother of Invention a feminist novel. First of all, whether or not you think there is such a thing as a feminist novel and what would constitute it, and then whether or not you think this novel falls into that category.
That's a great question. I set out to write a feminist novel. I wanted to create a protagonist who was anti-Sandbergian in a way. And in earlier drafts, I wrote a sort of fictional rejoinder to Lean In, Pushing Through, which is just now briefly excerpted in the novel. So I set out to write a feminist novel. I didn't specifically know how it was going to unfold, but I knew that I wanted to expose unrealistic expectations, lengths that women are expected to go and now very willingly go to make life more efficient, to sort of tether and tame the natural patterns of their bodies and reproductive systems. And so I knew I wanted to tackle those things. I thought that it would probably be somewhat satirical, like my first book. I didn't know exactly how it was going, but I wanted to write a feminist novel. As the book unfolded, and this is what I find most magical about the process of writing a novel, I sort of lost sight in a good way about the bigger ideas at work because I became so invested and so immersed in the characters and in their worlds. And 3 years in, the characters start to really acquire their own agency and the book takes on its own momentum. And yes, I still feel like it's a feminist novel, but more than anything, I think it's a novel about complex characters navigating complicated and dangerous situations. And my goal, you know, is really more for readers to care and to keep turning the pages. Ultimately, I do feel like it's a feminist novel. I know that, and, you know, I'm not going to cut straight to spoiling the end. I think that the end will definitely raise some questions about whether or not it is. But I guess at this point, I feel like the novel is just, it's complicated. Feminism is complicated. I feel like it's a feminist novel, but maybe not obviously so.
Okay. So tell me a little bit more about your process, you know, where you started with this book and then how these additional characters emerged in the writing. I'm always very interested to know when people start with something, they start with an initial idea and then how it evolves over time. You know, there's kind of three strands in this book. There's the story of Tessa Callahan and her cohort of women who are, you know, trying out this new technology. And then there is the story of Irene, who experienced accelerated gestation 20 years ago as a college student, and where she is now. And then the story of her daughter, who she had given up for adoption, doesn't really know that much about the story of her origins, but is now trying to investigate what caused this accelerated gestation, what are going to be the side effects, and is being viewed as a threat by the government.
I hope to never write another novel according to the process that I wrote this one according to. And, you know, I think in terms of craft, this novel was very difficult to write because I had a concept and I had the 9-week pregnancy and I sort of fell in love with that hook and with, you know, some of the things I was saying earlier about trying to write a fictional rejoinder to lean in. And so I wrote, the book was very idea heavy. It was very in Tessa's head. It was set mostly at Seahorse, at the research facility. And she was a vehicle for my ideas for a very long time. Gradually, I started introducing more characters because my early readers said that the book felt a little claustrophobic and a little, the presence of the writer, of me, was too palpable. So I gradually started writing some more points of view and adding in other characters, you know, and then the challenge becomes, well, how do they all connect? How can they all have their own discrete storylines that are urgent, but also, you know, relevant to the core thread? And so I there was so much trial and error. This book originally went out for sale at the end of 2014, which was a while ago. So, you know, we had a complete draft at the end of 2014. And over and over and over, the theme of the feedback I got was that Tessa did not live and breathe and was not a fully realized character. And so, you know, it took several more years of trying to get her to reveal herself to me, if you will, and also sort of diversifying my cast of characters and adding a brand new plot thread, sort of government conspiracy piece, came quite a bit later. So it was not a linear process. There were a lot of people involved. You know, my editor was tremendously influential. My agent was really helpful. My writing group was really helpful. So it was really sort of a, for Frankensteinian process and a huge learning experience. I will say for my third novel, I am heavily outlining, which is something I never thought I would do, structuring, researching, and being very methodical. For Mother of Invention, I was not at all.
Well, I'm fascinated to hear you say that you finished a first draft in 2014, because one of the questions that I wanted to ask you was how the current political climate influenced the writing of this book. There is a thread in the novel involving the government that has this program which removes people who have not committed any crime, but whom it considers a threat to its regime. It puts them in this secluded location known as the colony, where it offers them this chance to accept a revision, to go back out into the world with a revised narrative of their lives that would eliminate this perceived threat. And, you know, there's a lot around the surveillance state and what we're willing to sacrifice in terms of our individual freedom in order to have what we consider to be security, a lot that felt very resonant with a sort of post-2016 world. And so, I guess I'm curious about how intentional that was and how influenced by the things that were happening during that time frame that writing came to be.
I think it was definitely influential. You know, I wanted to keep it, sort of hovering, just sort of like hovering above the novel without seeming too directly influenced by the rise of Trump. But it was definitely there. You know, it was definitely there. And I feel like after 2016, we all are just operating in a different world with through a different lens and with different anxieties and fears. And I think my motivations changed for sure after 2016. And, you know, artistically and in my personal life and certainly in the way I'm observing the world and experiencing the news and, you know, worried, it directly unfolded that plot line. Yeah, I mean, in a way, I needed to wait this long because that's, you know, a quarter of the book or something.
Right, right. I'm wondering, you know, where you kind of realized that that needed to be a piece of the book.
In earlier versions, there's just been so many versions, but I'll tell you exactly. I remember exactly, I don't know about when, but why I realized it. The colony, which as you mentioned, is sort of this isolated holding area in the New Mexico desert where people who haven't done anything wrong are held. They're just perceived as threat to the government. Originally, the whole colony was structured around trying to conceal the accelerated gestation mistake, which I think, without giving anything away, there was a glitch in some FDA approvals, and, you know, some people suffered badly because of bad medical and pharmaceutical decisions. So I had the whole the colony, that whole thread was devoted exclusively to accelerated gestation. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember if I was my editor or a trusted reader said that it just didn't feel big enough. There's so many conspiracies and cover-ups and just darknesses out there that it was distracting. Or she was thinking, well, why this? Why is there, you know, this vast amount of government resources dedicated to just covering up this one phenomenon, that this one accident that affected a few dozen people? Way more than a few dozen people are mistreated and exploited. So I think I was trying to make the plot bigger and more expansive, kind of in its menacing, the menacing quality.
I want to go back to something you said before. This is your second novel. And your first one was not really a futuristic novel, as far as it didn't have these sort of science fiction-y elements. So I'm curious about the ways that this book felt different from your first, both in terms of, you know, the writing and in terms of the product, and if there were ways it felt the same, if you feel like there are themes that consistently motivate you and move you towards different kinds of stories that need telling.
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, there are consistent motivators, but I think they're very, very general. Complicated relationships, secrets. I mean, like, that's all boring. I mean, those are like big, you know, but it's interesting There's so little similarity between the two books, and the writing of them was completely different. I think it's pretty common with this first novel to write from, you know, sort of very close to your own ecosystem, right? And I live in LA, and, you know, I'm not in the, you know, my first book is set in the reality TV world, which is not my world, but I'm like adjacent to it and I'm sort of fascinated by it. And I was also pregnant when I wrote it and watching a lot of reality TV. And
I watched a lot of reality TV when I was pregnant.
Yes, exactly. It's a good thing to do when you're pregnant.
It is.
Yeah. So it was a very kind of small place. You know, I came from like a smaller source of inspiration. And I didn't do any research. It was nothing like Mother of Invention, where I did it backwards. I made everything up. I made up everything about reprogenetics and biotech and gene editing. I just made it up. I made up acronyms. I mean, any sort of real scientist who took a look at the first draft would, you know, they would be horrified. And I then like backed into real life substantiation. So I learned about CRISPR technology, which is essentially gene editing, and then brought it into the story just enough to win the reader's trust and to keep them from questioning or getting, you know, distracted by, you know, believability. So I did that sort of backwards researching, and that was a huge part of writing the book. And with Real Happy Family, it was just non-existent. I mean, that was just a forward push through character. In retrospect, it seemed like the first book was very easy to write. I'm sure it wasn't, but compared to number two, classically, the sophomore novel is the struggle, and that was true for me.
That's kind of like my children.
That's hilarious.
But were you at any point, did you sort of say to yourself, I'm writing a science fiction novel, like, is that what I do?
Yeah, and I had very low confidence, because I know my literary talents. Imagination is not at the top of my list, and I'm not being self-deprecating. It's really hard for me to fully imagine another world. So yeah, I was really intimidated. And, you know, early iterations of the book were far less of a commitment to, well, the colony didn't exist until much, much later, until the book had already gone out on submission once and then was kind of kicked back to me for a massive overhaul. So I kind of had to tell myself, like, I don't know what this is, you know, I don't know what this is, so that I could keep writing. Because if I told myself, this is science fiction, and everybody was asking me, what is it? You know, there are all these names, like, is it grounded science fiction? Is it, you know, speculative is the other buzz phrase. I never let myself classify it to myself, because I would have been paralyzed if I did.
Well, and let me ask you this too. So you send out the book on submission, it gets kicked back to you, like, no, this isn't working.
Yeah.
How do you decide, I'm going to keep working on it, and not, okay, it's time to move on to novel number three?
Yeah, that's just bullheaded stubbornness, I would say. I really love this book. I mean, it sounds familiar and trite, but it was the book I had to write. And whereas Real Happy Family, I was like, I don't know, 34 or something. And really my motivation was like, you need, like, what if you wrote 1,000 words a day? Like, what would happen if you got to 80,000 words? Could you sell a novel? So it was like a curiosity. It was a little challenge. With Mother of Invention, it was much more of a passion project. And because of that, I just didn't believe, of course I was daunted by the rejection, but I just didn't believe the editors who turned it down. I believed that there was a place for it.
Well, I want to wrap up by talking a little bit about the ending, which we touched on a little bit earlier, and I know you were a little bit reluctant to discuss, but I am going to give just one spoiler. So for anyone who's listening and hasn't finished the book, pause the podcast, go back and finish it, and then you can come and listen some more.
Yeah.
I don't think it gives everything away to say that at the very end of the novel, Tessa herself becomes a mother.
Right.
And I thought that was a really interesting choice. And as you yourself said earlier in the interview, a choice that might undermine a claim, but according to some people, might undermine this claim of like it being a feminist novel, because right. you have this character who throughout is so insistent that she just does not have this maternal urge. She does not want to become a mother, which I think a lot of feminists would say is a, you know, a real thing. And that is something that deserves to be validated and accepted and not seen as somehow outside of the norm. And yet in the end, she has kind of given into it and she loves motherhood, and it's an interesting choice. So I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you got to that place and why it felt right to you.
Yeah, I mean, my own mother, bless her, who's a wonderful reader, finished the book and drove over to my house and just said, I love this book, but why? You know, I don't understand the ending. And I'll tell you, Tessa did not get pregnant in the end until very, very, very late in my writing of the book. And I struggled with the ending over and over and over. I mean, yeah. And here's why. So I had always been opposed to having children. I did it, and it turned out that it didn't feel like a compromise, and that I'm still kind of opposed in that I love my children. I adore them, but I still don't feel like I'm naturally maternal. I don't feel that comfortable with children, not other people's children. And yet, you know, I can't, you know, it's hard to put original words around it, but I can't imagine my life experience without motherhood. But it doesn't feel at odds with being a feminist or even having trepidation about having children, even though I have them and I would never have it any other way. I still have trepidation. And so I felt like Tessa could have a child and still not compromise who she was or even her original stance, which sounds sort of crazy. But for me, it was my emotional truth, and this might just sound very egocentric. It was my emotional truth, and it had to be Tessa's.
Well, Shelley, it has been so enlightening talking to you today. Thank you so much for joining me.
It was a total pleasure, Sid. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and this is Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM. Take a moment to introduce my guests, Brian Slattery and Tui Sutherland. Brian is the author of a number of books, most recently the collaborative series Bookburners. Tui is also a prolific writer and is best known for her best-selling Wings of Fire series. They both recently appeared on Book Talk discussing Leah Stewart's novel, What You Don't Know About Charlie Outlaw. Brian and Tui, great to have you both back.
Thanks for having me back.
So we talked about this book a little bit in an email conversation prior to this taping. And Brian, I was struck by your saying that you did not think that a 9-week pregnancy would do all that much for women's liberation. Forgive me if I am misquoting you.
No, that's fair.
But that you felt so much.
Well, this is based on my wife's experience of pregnancy, of course.
Well, and that you felt that so much of the work-life challenge takes place after birth, and that shortening pregnancy doesn't really address that. Tui, I was really curious to know your reaction to that, and thought maybe we could start there.
Well, it's interesting because I found all of pregnancy like very terrifying anyway. So I'm not sure that I would change it just because I'd be so nervous about it. But on the other hand, I hated being pregnant. So if I knew it was really safe and I could do it faster, I could see the appeal for sure.
You know, for me, Brian, that was a really interesting thing to say because I similarly have had horrible pregnancies, even though I'm in my fifth and people therefore find it hard to believe. But I guess I'm just a masochist. But what was so interesting to me, especially the first time, was I feel like there's actually a lot of conversation in society today around work-life balance and what it means to both, you know, parent and have a career. And what there isn't conversation about is about pregnancy itself and how difficult it can be to be a pregnant person who is working. So especially with my first, I was working full-time then as a criminal defense attorney, and I was unbelievably sick. I fortunately had two wonderful, accommodating, understanding male bosses, but I thought, how can I be a functional employee while going through this? And it's going to last 9 months. And it made me feel like this is why not to hire women of childbearing age. Like, this is it right here. And no one's talking about it. Like, no one talks about it. And I think that's partly because women have really different experiences of pregnancy. And there are certainly women I've met who say they never felt better than when they were pregnant.
Right.
And what I think then happens is that women who have that experience tend to downplay the experience of other women who have had much harder pregnancies and think that it can't actually be as bad as these women are saying because there's not a uniform experience. There's not kind of a uniform sense of we as womankind are going through this and, you know, maybe we can talk about it. And so I felt incredibly isolated in that first pregnancy in particular of there being no discourse around how hard this was. For me, this concept of a 9-week pregnancy, you're absolutely right that it doesn't address the work-life balance of being a parent, you know, post-birth. But I did feel like the 9-week pregnancy addressed a real issue in how it is to be someone who wants to both work and bear children and how, for some women, that actually presents a tremendous challenge. So I was curious about the decision at the end of the book. And again, spoiler alert here for the listeners who haven't finished, they should go and finish first. But the decision at the end of the book that Tessa makes to abandon this project. Seahorse Solutions has more than just the 9-week pregnancy, although that's kind of the flagship innovation that they're making. Idea of the 9-week gestation gets abandoned. And it seems to me that the novel kind of presents a range of reasons for this. We learn, of course, that the whole technology behind it is a little bit suspect, that the genetic material was taken illegally to create this technology in the first place, that of course there are side effects that Tessa was unaware of, and that we don't know whether or not they will manifest in this new generation of accelerated gestation babies. But I wonder if you ended up feeling like the abandonment of that technology was for those reasons or because Tessa ends up coming down on the side that 9-week gestation is just a bad idea and that kind of messing with the natural order of things in this way is not something that we are meant to be doing.
That's a great question. It is, I actually feel a little unclear at the end, like what all the reasons were. I mean, I felt like the main reason was the sort of illegality of how they obtained the samples and came up with the process and also the potential side effects. But it was interesting to me that we didn't actually see any of the consequences of like the potential terrible consequences that could have come from the accelerated gestation. Like the mothers all turned out fine, the babies turned out fine, even the conjoined twins like were separated and they were both fine. So in the end the trial was kind of a success.
I mean, it is getting at those like very real questions in the world, right? About how much you want modern technology and medicine to be involved in your pregnancy, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It ranges from like the home birth crowd all the way to people who are constantly visiting the doctor, you know, who want all the painkillers and who want all of the
painkillers.
Yeah, of course. And like that is what
you never heard anyone preach the epidural like me.
That what's cool about that idea is how it's getting at those very real world questions about that. For most people now in the United States, at least, you know, going through pregnancy is a sort of collision with modern technology in some way or another. How much do you want to know about your baby while they're, you know, while they're in utero? Mm-hmm. How much do you want to know about their genetic makeup? Mm-hmm. You know, all of those questions are like super pertinent. I guess we should get around to this at some point, but the one scientist who is, Dr. Gupta, who is working on the project, it turns out that like she believes in the project, but probably wouldn't do it herself. And that was sort of a really interesting moment for me. There are probably so many people like that in the world, right? Where you say, what would you do? And you say, oh, the technology should be available. But then you go, what would you do? And right. They go, well, I wouldn't do it.
Well, and even, you know, Tessa, when she's speaking at her old college, talks about how this is about choice. And this is about presenting options, right? And it's not forcing it upon anybody, but it gives people the choice given what their lives look like and what they want their lives to look like. To maybe have some more power. But I think that can be a false choice. I think what can happen is there can be a way in which there then can be kind of subtle or not so subtle social pressure to engage in it because you are existing within a male system. So if you have a coworker who has 9-week pregnancy.
I thought the same thing.
Does everyone else who's in that office feel like I have to do that too?
I think there'd be incredible pressure from a lot of companies to make, they'd say like, by the way, this 9-week pregnancy thing that you think is an option, it's not really an option. We're going to pay for it and we're going to kind of make you do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't like sort of fix the patriarchy problem. In some ways, it gives it another tool for oppression, honestly.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think that what Shelley was getting at a little bit in the interview, and my feeling when I read the Sheryl Sandberg book, was there is an acknowledgement sort of like, this is the system.
Yeah.
And so we need to find ways to lean into the system and make the system work for us, but we're not going to change the system. And I think Tessa Callahan is very much a child of that conversation. The Anne Marie Slaughter article, which I read when it came out in The Atlantic and really stayed with me, I thought was really interesting because it seemed to me, the way I read it, was that what she was saying was, as long as this system exists, we're totally fooling ourselves to think we can have it all. And what we really need to happen is to change the system, and we really need to be pushing back.
But in a way, I think also, like, in order to change the system, first we have to get into the positions of leadership, right? Like, you, like she even says in the article something about, like, well, we probably can't make things better for the women at Walmart until we have, a female president. And so I can see an argument for, like, working within the system in order to get to the place where you can change the system. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I was really interested in the way that men in this book felt really unnecessary. So, you know, kind of speaking of this very male-dominated system and a world that seems to be structured by a kind of patriarchal identity. And yet the men function here in they definitely have functional roles, most of which are evil. Yet they also are surprisingly unimportant, right? So of the cohort, none of the three women have partners. And they've been chosen specifically because they don't have partners and they don't want someone else's emotions getting involved. But none of them seem to, like, miss it or need it or want to have a partner with them. Tessa, by the end, again, spoiler alert, does not have a partner. You know, she is also a single mother. There's never a mention in, you know, any part of the book, including the end, that any of them need that. It was an interesting idea to me. On the one hand, they're operating in this patriarchal society and the technology seems sort of geared to allow them to operate within it. And on the other hand, they have this very matriarchal experience of, like, we're going to raise our completely woman-dominated family together, supporting each other, and we don't need men in order to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if either of you had a reaction to that.
Well, this was one of the parts of the book that I found pretty refreshing. Part of it is that I like stories where people make weird families. You know, it's one of those. Yeah, I always love the idea that people can make their own families out of whoever they have around, and that we don't need these sort of typical gender or age or whatever it is. In this book, I definitely liked how the script got flipped that way. You know, it actually made them feel like more real people. You know, that people who can make their own decisions, people who are just looking at what's around them and using what's there instead of, you know, pining for something that isn't there. You know, you could argue that the book made it easy on itself, and that, like, you know, Peter is a pretty, like, non-entity guy. You know, like, he wants to have a kid, but given that he doesn't have a kid, he doesn't do anything. You know, and I thought, well, that's an interesting sort of person who has zero ambitions besides going surfing.
Yeah.
You know, and that, like, you know, Luke, the financier, is kind of in the same boat, where he just has a giant pile of money, and his response to that is to kind of, like, do kind of projects. You know, what was funny is, like, left hanging in the air is the idea that maybe this project is an project also. You know, it's marketed in the book as, like, this is the first one that really matters, but what if it isn't? You know, what if it's just the one that's, like, well, three people tried it and it was okay.
I wanted to talk about Peter a little bit more. I'm interested in your take on him, Brian. I actually felt like Peter's really interesting because I feel like there's a real reversal of gender roles that goes on with him.
Yes.
You know, I can definitely,
like, except that he has no responsibilities.
Well, I can definitely, so for me, he was actually a reminder of certain couples I know, not most of them in this day and age, but I definitely know some where the woman never really had a career, that she maybe had some artistic ambitions or, you know, had like some jobs out of college, but it was never totally career focused.
Right.
Got married in, like, their late 20s and then became the stay-at-home mom, and the husband was the one who went off and, you know, had the career, and the woman was found, like, fulfillment in, you know, being the stay-at-home mom. And even though that sounds super 1950s, I definitely know families who have who mimic that. And even my own family, you know, even though I'm a lawyer and even though I've worked in a nonprofit, you know, for basically since my first daughter was born, I went down to half time and now I'm just doing some consulting. And definitely the vast majority of my time is around like childcare and child rearing and housekeeping and all of that stuff. Like, and, you know, my husband's career is much more of the focus. And so I definitely could see Peter in the mold of someone who has definitely supported himself, you know, since college. Right. He's not a grifter.
Yeah, and, for sure.
But
for sure.
He doesn't like, you know, his career's never been his focus. He really loves nature and he loves finding the things to do that he feels passionate about.
Right.
And he doesn't need to make a lot of money or to be kind of an important person.
Right.
And when he then marries Tessa, like what he wants is to have a family. And yes. I did not find myself like looking down on him for that or feeling like he was not as admirable as Tessa. But what I found so interesting was like it felt like a total reversal of what you would expect in terms of the male, female gender expectations.
Yes. And as someone who is living that dream, like
Peter, Brian.
There was a lot to it. I mean, yeah. I mean, he and I have a lot in common for sure.
I always describe you as a non-entity.
Well, that's how I identify myself also. As, you know, someone who is kind of living that life. Steph and I talk about that all the time, that there are people who think our lives are really weird. And then we tell them, like, if you flip the gender roles, it's not weird, is it? And they go, yeah, it isn't. It's totally normal. And we're like, yes, all we've done, we have like a traditional marriage. It just happens to be that we flipped it over. We just flipped the script. And it's interesting the way that like people have a lot of trouble wrapping their heads around that. There's wisdom in the traditional division of labor if you take out the gender roles. You know, the whole idea of one person goes out, one person stays home. Mm-hmm. And it gets rid of all these sort of managerial decisions you have to constantly make. Who's going to the store? Who's cooking? Who's doing this? Who's doing that? It's really great to not have to talk about that every single day, you know, and to sort of have it be that we all know what our responsibilities are here and we can just do it instead of constantly managing it. It's interesting how many in my own experience of being in this sort of couple, like how many people find it really weird when you flip the genders over. And that, like, this book does a pretty neat job of kind of pointing all of that out, that we are encouraged to sort of judge Tessa and judge Peter according to societal norms in a way that we definitely wouldn't if those roles were reversed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we, you know, in some ways we judge Tessa less, I think, because we are much closer to her in the narrative.
Yeah.
And so we're automatically more on her side. But I do think that there's a tendency to kind of like see Peter as kind of weak and needy. And, you know, Tessa in some ways sees him
well,
that
and to
way.
See Tessa as domineering. All of those like horrendous stereotypes that people threw around with Hillary Clinton during the campaign.
Right.
I mean, I think Tessa, interestingly, is set up at the beginning in sort of a classic villain sort of way. Like a lot of the initial things were told about her. I really do. Starting with like trying to change the natural like, way childbirth works. And that she is happy to be away from her husband for a while to focus on her work. And like, she doesn't ask about their dog the whole time.
I mean, like, really, that's the most damning thing about her, right?
I know. and yet at the end, we really do come to a place, I feel like, I think that we're supposed to come to a place where she is kind of the hero. Like she does, you know, save Viv and she does stop Luke from doing this anymore. And she also like, she doesn't blame herself for Peter leaving, which I liked. She's like, really, it was Peter who didn't understand me. It was, you know, there's a line in there where she's like, Peter was sort of, Peter had been the one who'd made her feel divided in a perpetual struggle to tamp down certain parts of herself to cultivate others. It's not his fault, she says, you know, he was doing the best he could, but he needed a different kind of woman than she was. And she doesn't feel bad about that, which I thought was kind of great.
Yeah, although I, you know, actually it was the one point where I felt like I started to diverge from Tessa. Like I wanted almost her to be a tiny bit harder on herself because I felt like Peter, at least what we see of him, is very accepting of her. And I never see him really asking her to be other than she is, except in ways that seem reasonable, right? Like we're having dinner, like let's try to be present and not check our phones, you know? And he wants to have a child, but he's like, I'll do everything. Like, I'll give the bottles, I'll change the diapers, I want to be the stay-at-home parent, I'm not asking you to be different, but, you know, I want to be able to have this experience. It felt to me like he really wasn't asking her to be different. So I was a little surprised that that was her reaction and takeaway. And I felt like, you know, maybe ultimately he did want someone who could be more kind of available than she was. But I wasn't ready to judge him as harshly as she did in that moment.
Well, I don't think I felt like she wasn't really judging him so much as saying like, well, he wanted something different. I actually was ready to judge him more harshly. I was like, I can't believe that. I think that when he was like, I met someone else and I want to leave you for him, and it's not because you wouldn't have or you couldn't have kids. I think he's lying. I think it's completely about the kids. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't seem to blame him for that in any way. And in fact, then she goes and has his kid and he still leaves. So the way it was set up is like him leaving her could have been like, oh, she's the villain and he's better off without her. But the fact that she didn't see it that way, and we were given this sort of like peaceful epilogue where she's like at peace with what's happened and moving on, I thought that was a really interesting choice.
Yeah, I did too.
I also thought it was interesting. You know, you say she set up kind of as the classic villain in the very beginning, but the evolution that we see with her, I felt like was an evolution of kind of maternal qualities.
Yeah.
You know, she starts as this very kind of hard-nosed executive. She has, you know, good relationships with her underlings, but there's a certain professional distance. But with the cohort, she feels like she needs to befriend them and be much more emotionally present for them. And even though it's talked about in terms of friendship, it definitely felt to me like she was mothering them. And we kind of see her become a mother over the course of this novel. And it was kind of speaking to the ways that, like, actually these maternal attributes and qualities can make a person actually more empowered. You know, both within the business world within she operates and within her own life. And I feel like that then her actually becoming a mother at the very end is kind of the physical embodiment of what we've actually seen happen over the course of the rest of the novel.
And that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm with you on that for sure.
Yeah. I just wanted to go back to the men question for a second, the whole idea of the men in the book, because I thought one of the interesting things about them was the fact that they do terrible things, in particular Luke and Wayne, and they're not punished for it. Like, I thought that was so, like, especially Wayne.
I didn't think Wayne was going to survive the book, actually.
Yeah, I kind of felt like he shouldn't. It was like, and at the end, Viv seemed so happy.
Or I thought he was going to end up in jail or something.
Yeah, but he didn't. He just seemed to be, like, he came back into their lives, and Viv was, I mean, not displeased to see him.
Right.
And Luke is never punished for stealing the samples and lying to Tessa and all the ways that he lies to her. I mean, except I guess that his project is ended and he has to do something else.
But that one made more sense to me because you're just like, that man is rich enough to buy his way out of just about any problem he might have, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it does feel in some ways like the men, even though they have the power, in certain ways are very weak. And, you know, subject to kind of being manipulated by both the system and their own emotions. So, you know, Wayne, who has had this really terrible home life, is very susceptible to a power structure that offers him, you know, kind of stability and support. And once he's in it and he realizes the ways that it is not morally ethical, he finds himself unable to leave. Right? He doesn't have the inner strength to be able to push, but he doesn't have the strength of like an Irene who refuses to accept her revision at the colony and becomes a permanent resident because she will not give in to their demands. He does not have that kind of inner strength. And you have Luke who, even though his childhood is not comparable to Wayne's in terms of like the abuse and dysfunction, has his own kind of dysfunctional abandonment issues with his father. And you know, everything he does and every way, every action he takes seems to be a reaction to that abandonment and his kind of need to live up to this imagined father's approval.
Yeah, well,
whereas the women don't seem to like necessarily be seeking anyone's approval, right? Like the women are, you know, whether it's Viv or Irene or Tessa or the cohort, actually, even though they're not the ones who like run the world, they're the ones who have the strength. And that also was like, we talked in the interview about like, is this a feminist novel? In some ways, I think that almost more than anything is what makes it a feminist novel.
I think that with Luke and Wayne, a lot of their weakness actually comes from their toxic masculinity. Mm. Like, I think that they're weak in a macho way. Like, Wayne is like the classic cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
Comes in with the guns and the kidnapping. Luke is like what we think of as like sort of the tech bro.
For sure.
Totally.
Yeah. And I think that they both, so it's interesting to see it as weakness, but I think it's true. I think that they're, because of their vision of what they're supposed to be, they're sort of this, you know, macho version of themselves. I think that's what makes them so weak.
Fragile maybe is the word we're searching for.
Yeah. Or dysfunctional, maybe just dysfunctional.
Yeah, yeah. But messed up. They're just messed up.
But it's, yeah. it is very interesting that they are not ultimately punished.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really interesting choice.
Yes.
Well, Brian and Tui, as ever, we could keep going, but we need to wrap up. It has been great talking with both of you. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you, Sid.
Yeah, thanks for having us again.
I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and this is Book Talk on WNHH Community Radio, 103.5 FM. Next up, New Haven librarian Margaret Gerges recommends the book J. Edgar Hoover, A Graphic Biography by Rick Geary.
Hi, this is Margaret Gerges, teen librarian at the New Haven Free Public Library. This week I'm reviewing J. Edgar Hoover, A Graphic Biography by Rick Geary. This title is a perfect match for history and biography lovers looking for a lot of information packed into a relatively short book. It's only about 100 pages and is a graphic novel, so at first you might think you won't learn much from it, but you'd be wrong. Starting with his birth and education, the biography explains Hoover's family, his upbringing, and his launch onto a federal career path. But fleshing out the story is a wide range of information about his beliefs and his personal life. His personal moral code strongly influenced the establishment and direction of the FBI for many years. As Nazism and then communism took hold in Europe, Hoover was able to capitalize on Americans' fears of a similar takeover and build a surveillance network so strong that even the president's own family was not immune from scrutiny. Many in the government questioned Hoover's extreme tactics. He thought nothing of bending the rules outlined in the Constitution to fit his will when he thought it necessary. At the same time, however, they, along with Hoover, encouraged the newspapers, comics, publishers, and movie studios of the time to present agents in the most favorable light possible. They used the successes of the police and government against notorious villains like John Dillinger, Machine Gun Kelly, and others to create a facade of heroism in the FBI that likely helped hide some of their questionable tactics. Hoover claimed not to believe in individual recognition in government work, yet he did not seem to shy away from journalists and newspapermen that would make him the face of those so-called heroes and protectors of the American way of life. Hoover was excellent at his job, and he made himself indispensable. He played the political game so neutrally that he was no one's enemy, but was he anyone's friend? He was very much in the public eye, yet so private that even today some aspects of his personal life remain shrouded in mystery. Who was this man who had such influence on the American perception of the world, who left such a legacy that there is a movie about him entitled simply J. Edgar? Just a reminder, you can find this title and all books reviewed here at the New Haven Free Public Library at 133 Elm Street, New Haven. You can also stop in and visit our teen center located on the lower level of the library. We will be happy to help you find this or any other titles that you are seeking.
Thanks, Margaret. On our next show, airing June 27th, we'll be talking about the new novel, The Great Believers, first with the author, Rebecca Mackay, and then with my guests, Annie Toms and Jessica Sager. This will be Rebecca's second appearance on the show, as a couple of years ago we featured her last novel, The 100-Year House. Both books are terrific if you're looking for some summer reading. You can listen to that old episode and all our others, and see what else is coming up on our website, booktalkradio.net. And, as always, you can offer your thoughts on this episode or any other on Facebook or Twitter, or by emailing me directly at booktalkwnhh@gmail.com. Until next time, happy reading.